The first principle of functionalism was that every organism capable of feeling pain or whatever the psychological state in question may be is a probabilistic automata, and that's implied already by the second thing as well. There's some redundancy in these axioms. Every organism capable of feeling pain possesses at least one probabilistic description of a certain kind K. That is, being capable of feeling pain just is possessing a description of a certain kind. Three, no organism capable of feeling pain possesses a decomposition into parts which separately possess a description of kind K. So that means that Australia and the United States do not literally feel pain because they have a decomposition into parts which separately feel pain. This, by the way, three, if you take that to mean a decomposition of parts, at least one of which, then that would rule out Searle's Chinese room, which was proposed much later. Four, for every probabilistic automaton description of the relevant kind K, there exists a subset of the sensory input. So these are not, these, the probabilistic automata I'm talking about are not supposed to be pure automata, automata with no sense organs. They are supposed to be automata with mechanical sense organs of some kind and mechanical motor organs, which means among the things they can do is accept things that are printed on the tape by the sense organs or print on a second tape which instructs motor organs. For every probabilistic automaton description of kind K, there exists a subset of the sensory inputs such that an organism with that description is in pain if and only if its inputs are in that subset. So to summarize, a human being or an animal or any animal, or this is of course pain is a state we ascribe to organisms much simpler than humans, organisms with virtually no brains at all, but to be an organism capable of feeling pain or a robot capable of feeling pain, you have to have at least a certain kind, which is not specified here, notice, of description. There's some set of descriptions, perhaps an infinite set of descriptions, so that one of those has to be your probabilistic automaton description. And to be in pain, to be capable of feeling pain, is just to have a description of that kind. And to actually be in pain is to have a description of that kind and to have a sensory input in an appropriate subset. Now, I admitted that the hypothesis was very vague. I mean, what's the kind K? Could be an infinite class of descriptions. Is it a definable class? Is it specifiable in non-intentional terms? Is it specifiable otherwise than just as the set of descriptions such that something without description is capable of feeling pain? I admitted that the hypothesis was very vague, but I argue that, quote, in spite of its admitted vagueness, it is far less vague than the physical chemical state hypothesis today and far more susceptible to investigation of both a mathematical and an empirical kind, close quotes. And then I added, and this reveals the extent of what I would call my scientism at that time, quote, indeed, to investigate this hypothesis is just to attempt to produce mechanical models of organisms. And isn't this, in a sense, just what psychology is all about? The difficult step, of course, I'm still reading from this manifesto, the difficult step, of course, will be to pass from models of specific organisms to a normal form for the psychological description of organisms. For this is what is required to make 2 and 4 precise. But this, too, seems to be an inevitable part of the program of psychology. Close quotes. In a paper that ended up being published in the same year, The Mental Life of Some Machines, in that paper I closed by allowing that while the functional organization of a Turing machine or a probabilistic automaton is given by something called the machine table, the description of the functional organization of a human being, quotes, might well be something different and more complicated, end quotes. But like the paper from which I just quoted, I do not doubt that the very raison d'etre of psychology is to produce mechanical models of organisms. Nor does that paper express any reservations about the idea that it is, quote, an inevitable part of the program of psychology, unquote, to provide a normal form for the psychological description of organisms. Not just for the psychological description of human beings, please note, as if that were not utopian enough, but a normal form for the psychological description of an arbitrary organism. Once psychology has progressed far enough in the pursuit of this, quote, inevitable program to make the hypothesis that mental states are just functional states precise, it will be possible, or so I claimed, to confirm the hypothesis in a way analogous to the way in which we have confirmed theoretical identifications in physics. The laws of unreduced psychology, vernacular psychology, to the extent that they are true, will be explained by the fact that the psychological states they speak of are really these functional states, just as the laws of optics, unreduced optics, to the extent that they were true, were explained by the fact that the light rays and light waves they spoke of were really electromagnetic radiation of certain wavelengths. Well, let's now, as I say, the idea that we literally are Turing machines, which was the, or probabilistic automata, which is the way in which I originally proposed functionalism, quickly came to seem untenable. And at the beginning of Philosophy in Our Mental Life, I expanded on my qualms about supposing that psychological states of human beings are literally Turing machine states. In these papers, I frequently spoke generally of Turing machines rather than more precisely of probabilistic automata. I recognized that, quote, the difficulty with the notion of psychological isomorphism is that it presupposes the notion of something's being a functional or psychological description. And I went on to say that it's for that reason that in my previous papers I explained the notion in terms of Turing machines. And I remarked that that was the reason I felt constrained to defend the idea that we are Turing machines. Turing machines, I explained, come with a normal form for their functional description, the machine table, a standard style of program. Here's one possible, very simple explanation of what a Turing machine is. Turing machine, the name comes with it. This was invented by Alan Turing, after whom Turing machines are named, but first of all, they have a finite number of states. And they say, secondly, they have a tape divided into separate squares. And there it is. In addition, the machine has a scanning head. And at any one time, the machine is scanning exactly one square. There's the scanning head. So the tape can be moved either left or right one square at a time, which has the effect of causing the scanning head to either scan the next square to the right or the next square to the left of whichever square it's scanning at a given stage. It moves in discrete stages, so it also has the option, depending on its instructions, of not moving. So if the tape at a given stage is scanning a particular square, as you see here, then at the next stage it may still be scanning that same square, or it may now be scanning this square. You can either think of the scanning head as moving, or more easily of the tape as shifting, or at the next stage it may be scanning this square. And of course, there are symbols, typically symbols, and we count blank space always as a symbol. There are symbols written on the tape. At the beginning of a computation, typically there'll be a finite number of symbols written on the tape, and you might think of the computation as beginning always with the scanning head scanning the first symbol in the list of symbols that are originally printed on the tape. So you might have something like this on the tape. Think of these as a rather primitive notation for numbers. A single one means one, three tallies means three. So this says 1 plus 3, and the machine has just was started by scanning this one, and then it moved right one, and it's now scanning this plus and thinking about what to do. So in addition to having for any given Turing machine, you have a tape, you have a scanning head, you have a symbol from a finite, you have symbols from a finite alphabet, and one of those, including blank space, may be printed, and exactly one may be printed in each square. And apart from the symbols which were typed onto the tape by the operator when he set the problem, when the machine is actually running, further printing can only be done on the square which the scanning head is scanning. So, for example, one way in which this machine might operate, I'll give you a program for doing that in a minute, is if it's scanning this plus and in the appropriate state, it might erase that plus and print a 1 instead. And then when it's done that, it might then go into state which tells it to go back to the beginning, so it finds a blank, and then move back, so now to identify the beginning of the string and erase this one, and then go into a rest state, a state in which nothing happens ever. That would be one way of adding. And in fact, here's a program for doing that, exactly that way. The key point is the Turing machine is completely described by a machine table. Now, this leads to some confusion. Mathematicians often think of the Turing machine as the table, which makes the machine an abstract object. I prefer to think, and this was Turing's intention, of a Turing machine as a concrete realization of the machine table. So, of course, from a mathematical point of view, machines that have the same machine table are identical. So here's a sample machine table. It's a table for doing exactly what I just described, for adding in this rather primitive notation. So you see here, you have three symbols, which are called S1, S2, S3. Notice that the machine table has as many rows as there are symbols in the alphabet. That's always finite. One of them is always the blank space. And it has many columns as there are states, as the machine is supposed to have computationally relevant states. So this machine, the machine with this table, is supposed to have 4 computationally relevant states, of which the fourth one, D, is a rest state. You can tell it's a rest state because you notice C here means continue scanning the same square. The fact that you have a C in every instruction in this column means that if the machine is ever in state D, if the machine is in state D, it stays in state D, no matter what it's scanning. If it's scanning S, symbol S1, which is the first symbol to 1, it prints an S1, which has the effect of not changing what was on the tape. It continues scanning the same square, and it stays in state D. If it's scanning S2, it prints S2, which is to say it doesn't change anything. It doesn't move left or right. It centers, C for center, and it stays in state D. If it's scanning S3, again, it prints S3, which doesn't change anything. It centers, which doesn't change anything, and stays in the same state. So D is a dead state. If you ever get into state D, you never get out of it, and you never do anything. It's the rest state, as the name implies. Now, the other states are the active states. If the machine is started scanning a 1, and in state A, which is the state we imagine the state being in whenever it starts a computation, it goes right 1 square and stays in state A. So if it hits another 1, it'll print that 1 back and go right again. So if you have a row of 1s, the machines will go tick, 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 leaving those 1s, staying in state A, but hunting. It keeps moving to the right until, if it's a properly formed problem, it hits a plus. When it hits a plus in state A, it says, aha, that's not indicated. It replaces the plus with a 1, goes into a new state B, and it goes left. And if the machine, the machine, let's say, will now hit a 1, because it just moved right onto the plus row, at least 1, 1. So when it's in state B and it hits a 1, it leaves the 1 and continues going left, till eventually it hits a blank. because there are only a finite number of symbols on the tape to begin with. And what's in state B, and it hits a blank, it leaves that blank and goes back right, but now in a new state, C. So now the machine hits the first one, the very tally that it began with, but when it hits this one the second time, it's not hitting it in state A, it's hitting it in state C. And when it hits this one in state C, it replaces it by a blank. It erases it and goes left and goes into the rest state. So this machine will do what I described. If you give it a problem like 1, 1, any number of 1s, plus 1, 1, 1, 1, it'll add correctly. And the way it adds is by moving to the right, so it hits that plus, replaces that plus by a 1, moving to the left, so it hits a blank, goes into state B, goes back to that first one, erases it, and goes into the rest state. The amazing thing is that anything that any computer at all can do in principle can be done by some Turing machines. In fact, there's this one single Turing machine called the universal machine with a machine table which is, and at least some universal machines have not very big machine tables, which can, given enough time, do anything any computer at all can do. Now the important thing is, what do you mean by a computational Turing machine state? The answer is, to know what a Turing machine state is, I have to do what I just did. I have to tell you what a Turing machine is. I have to say what the formalism is, what a machine table is. And then I say, anything whose behavior can be, under a reasonable idealization, can be described by this formalism of a Turing machine, and the relevant states are its computational states. So what's the upshot? Okay, well, this just finishes what I just told you. The machine I described, if the tape originally read 1, 1, plus 1, 1, 1, the machine adds in the way I just described. I just explained what a Turing machine is, and it's the factor what a Turing machine state is. But that's quite general. If you add some other formalism, like Church's or Cleaney's, etc., something analogous would hold. A formalism for computation theory, what used to be called recursion theory, some people still call it recursion theory, defines a kind of device. Device in a very broad sense. A device needn't be a machine, which is the way Alan Turing thought of it. It could be a system of equations. And two, any formalism defines what counts as a relevant state of that device. But what I've been leading up to is the bottom of this transparency, which is that talk of computational states, when no formalism has been specified, is science fiction, not science. We don't know what we mean when we say that psychological states of human beings are functional states, in this sense, unless we specify what the formalism is supposed to be. I have a paper that is called, Functionalism, Cognitive Science or Science Fiction. I look to see if the book is in your library today, but it isn't, but it's in a new book called The Future of the Cognitive Revolution, edited Oxford University Press, edited by David Johnson and Christina Annalink.